This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Space rockets today and cricket and some economic news, sure. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 13th of July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And we begin on this Thursday where the money is. Big Wall Street banks start reporting second quarter earnings tomorrow. JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo lead the way. Others will come all through next week. And we lead with tomorrow's news today because rote, though they sometimes can be, this will be the first full quarter of bank earnings since the regional banking crisis of this past spring. And because if you know what you're looking for, bank earnings can tell you some things about our economic future. Marketplace's Samantha Fields gets us going.
Think of bank earnings like a thermometer for the economy, regional banks for local economies, and big banks,
they're effectively a thermometer of the U.S. economy.
Nathan Stovall is director of financial institutions research at S&P Global Market Intelligence. There are a few main things he'll be looking at as those earnings reports start coming out tomorrow, including what's going on with deposits and with loan portfolios.
Are they becoming less willing to lend because they're worried about where we are in the economic cycle and potential problems ahead?
And are banks starting to see any warning signs, like borrowers falling behind on loans, especially commercial real estate loans?
Is it business as usual? Are they preparing for stress? Are they clamoring for more deposits?
All of that, he says, can tell us a lot. Stephen Kelly at the Yale Program on Financial Stability says these second quarter earnings should be especially interesting,
because the bank crisis really happened in March,
near the end of the first quarter.
So it was hard to see exactly all those effects play out from just Q1. So we'll see a full quarter of sort of post-crisis bank activity, and that will give us a good sense of how things have changed inside banks since then.
How they're doing financially, and also how they're reading the economy. But Anat Admati, a professor of finance at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, says there's also plenty that bank earnings reports don't reveal. Case in point.
So I just went for fun to see the last two earnings reports of First Republic Bank. If you looked at them January, the quarter four reports, things were great, completely great. I mean, everything was up, everything was wonderful.
But by late April, when First Republic put out its first quarter earnings report, things were not so rosy. And just 1 week later, the bank collapsed. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Wall Street, as we head into the end of the week, again, traders are just looking for reasons to buy. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Well, here we are, four something minutes into the program, and the word inflation has yet to appear, which is on purpose because honestly, sometimes you just got to step back. But With the rise in prices now clearly slowing, 12 straight months of disinflation, if you're counting, which of course we are, we thought it might be instructive to take stock of exactly where we are in this inflation economy. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab got the assignment.
It's been a long time since we've heard the phrase transitory inflation. Fed Chair Jerome Powell decided the label wasn't so accurate in late 2021. But Moody's Analytics economist Mark Zandi thinks the T word is still the right way to describe this period.
Certainly didn't feel that way because it's taken a long time to work through those effects because those shocks were so massive and they're global.
He's talking about the pandemic supply chain snarls, which affected the cost of goods, and the initial impact of the war in Ukraine, which affected the cost of gas and food. These played an outsized role in inflation and have largely subsided.
We're probably two-thirds of the way there, and that last third is going to take a bit of time, I think.
Part of what's left in that last third includes the transitory category that's come to define this time, used cars. Omer Sharif is president of Inflation Insights.
It has had such a dramatic impact on these month-to-month readings, but we are finally starting to see a bit more caution in that particular market.
Supply is starting to catch up to demand. Another area where this is happening is domestic airfare. What economists worry more about is persistent underlying inflation. Sharif says even one of its biggest contributors, housing, is starting to look better.
We know already what's happening to new lease rent growth, which is that it's close to zero or declining in most parts of the country.
It takes about a year for that to show up in the consumer price index. Now, this is the part of the story where I contradict all the happy things I just said. For one, economists expect healthcare costs, a traditionally big piece of underlying inflation, to rise. Two, this last leg of inflation is the hardest to cool. And three, economist Carola Binder at Haverford College says those temporary shocks were just getting over.
There can and will always be more.
If the last few years have taught us anything, it's that surprises are a big part of the economy. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Everything's transitory if you wait long enough. Am I right? You know what is forever, though? The lengths to which David Brancaccio and our morning report team will go to get you ready for your economic day. Give it a listen, would you? Over the past year, migrants have been crossing or attempting to cross the southern U.S. border by the hundreds of thousands per month. Texas and Florida, in turn, have sent thousands of asylum seekers via bus and plane to cities in more progressive states, which has left those cities the challenge of housing those asylum seekers. In Chicago, the sheer pace of new arrivals has strained the city's shelter system, and a lack of affordable housing might make for a long wait. From WBEZ, Tessa Weinberg has that story.
On a recent Wednesday, a truck full of secondhand furniture pulls up in front of a basement apartment on a tree-lined street in Chicago. Movers unload a bed.
We're supposed to set them up for you. Do you need us to set them up, or you want to take care of?
No, we're going to set them.
You're going to set them yourself?
Yeah. All right, okay.
The new residents here are Joseph and Martin. We're only using their last names for their safety. They're moving into their first Chicago apartment after fleeing political upheaval in their native Nicaragua.
I'm home finally. I have a place where I could get home.
Martin says they slept in city shelters for nearly 9 months before getting the keys to their new place.
Finally, I'm going to sleep in my own bed.
Their rent is covered by the state. About $11 million federal relief dollars have been dispersed in Illinois to more than 1,000 asylum seekers. Applicants can get rent assistance for up to 6 months. The program helps free up space in maxed-out city shelters. Christina Passioni-Zayas is with the Chicago mayor's office. She says it's not okay that hundreds of new arrivals have to sleep in police station lobbies because there are just no beds.
We don't want people to be staying in police stations. We need people in temporary shelters so that they can be on their path to resettlement.
She says when asylum seekers move into permanent housing, then they can start to rebuild their lives.
We want people to be self-determined, self-actualized, self-sustainable.
About 600 landlords participate in the Illinois program. While they get rent money from the state, they still vet prospective tenants.
criminal backgrounds, credit scores, credit history, rental history.
That's Luz Maria Cortez. She works for La Casa Norte, a Chicago nonprofit that helps asylum seekers apply for rent assistance. Cortez says sometimes large property management companies don't approve applications from new arrivals who don't have much of a background to check.
They just got to the United States, so they don't have any of that. So more than 90% of the time, I would say that they're getting denied for those apartments.
It's a problem that's playing out across the U.S., given a lack of affordable housing nationwide. Ellen Beatty works on the International Rescue Committee's Resettlement, Asylum, and Integration team. She says rising rents don't help.
On average, a 12% increase year over year in the rental rates.
The IRC offers asylum seekers loans for up to 6 months of rent that they can pay back with no interest. But here's the thing. 6 months of assistance often runs out before asylum seekers can legally work. They can't apply for a work permit until about 5 months after submitting their asylum application.
It could take 12 to 18 months before they are fully documented and able to work while still pending the outcome of their asylum case.
That leaves many asylum seekers looking for work wherever they can. Like Martin, the woman moving into the basement apartment. She says she did find a job as a caregiver, but it was short-lived without a work permit.
I made it for 6 weeks, but I had to leave because I didn't have a permit, and they were asking me.
Martin's three sons are still in Nicaragua with her parents. She hopes to bring them to Chicago one day. She's excited to show them her new apartment over WhatsApp. She already knows what they'll say.
They would be happy. They would say, Mommy, I want to go. Yeah, since you have a home now and you are not in a shelter, we could go now. Yeah, they would be very happy to be here.
For now, she moves forward with something she's had nearly a year to practice, patience. In Chicago, I'm Tessa Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The sea calls, so you do what you gotta do.
As one does when the sea calls. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 47 points, about a 10%, close to 34,395. Here's why you get the very happy music. The NASDAQ ascended 219 points, 1.6%, 14,138. The S&P 500 increased 37 points, 0.8%. 45 and 10. You've probably seen this news come across your feeds today. The FDA has approved the first ever over-the-counter birth control pill. No word yet on how much the pill is going to cost, but its manufacturer, Perrigo, out of Dublin, says it will become available in 2024. Perrigo shares gained about 0.5% today. And other healthcare industry stocks, CVS up about 1%. Walgreens slid 1.9% today. Samantha Fields was just telling us about banks. So here you go. Bank of America and Wells Fargo both climbed about 1% today. Citigroup gained about 0.6%. Morgan Stanley also up by about 0.5% on this day. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.76%. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. About 7,000 people are expected to pack into a former minor league ballpark near Dallas tonight, but baseball it will not be. The game they'll see instead will feature hitters with fat bats swinging at bouncing balls, the first game of a new professional cricket league for the United States. The bat and ball sport that's kind of but not really like baseball is hugely popular in a lot of places that used to be part of the British Empire. Here, though, no. The people behind the startup, Major League Cricket, are hoping to change that. They've invested $100 million to set up a six-team league with rosters that include international stars that'll compete over the next 2 weeks. The league is banking on interest from South Asian communities here, but the road to profit, as Marketplace's Henry App reports, could be bumpy.
Cricket has grown a lot in the U.S. since Ravi Atwaru started his cricket equipment business in the Bronx in 2006.
We have local schools, high schools now taking part in cricket. We have college cricket.
Much of that growth is thanks to South Asian immigration to the U.S. Cricket has a huge fan base in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Now, Major League Cricket hopes to take the sport pro here and tap into those growing communities and their enthusiasm, says the league's spokesperson, Tom Dunmore.
This probably wouldn't have the same upside if we were doing this in the 1980s or even early 90s.
There are now over 5 million Americans with roots in South Asia, plus there are expats from other cricket hotbeds, the UK, Australia, South Africa, and the Caribbean. Stefan Szymański, a professor of sport management at the University of Michigan, says the next question is,
would Americans take this on wholesale? And that's probably going to take a lot longer.
Major League Cricket is keeping its ambitions relatively small for now. The season is just 2 weeks long, and even though all of its matches will be played in Texas and North Carolina this year, its teams are assigned homes: LA, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Washington, and Texas, all locations where the league hopes to build stadiums. Even if it manages to expand, profitability could be even farther off, says Victor Matheson, a sports economist at the College of the Holy Cross.
This is not something you measure success in months or years. It really is something you measure in decades.
Even the NFL took that long to get a foothold, he says.
The folks that think, if we can just get through year one or two, we're set, are deceiving themselves.
The league says its inaugural season will be broadcast in cricketing nations around the world. And if you want to watch it here, you have to subscribe to a channel called Willow TV. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Last year, from planet Earth, there were almost 180 rockets launched successfully into orbit, basically one every other day, and there were scores of other launches to suborbital altitudes. The spaceports, whence those rockets launch, aren't quite as gritty as the ones we might be familiar with from Star Wars, but as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from one of the country's busiest launch sites, they do play pretty big roles in their local economies.
Parts of rockets line the walls of a cavernous room at NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia. College students tinker with wires and electrical components under the hood of a rocket that will carry temperature, acceleration, and radiation detectors to an altitude of 70 miles. Jonathan Chinana is a senior at Navajo Technical University, and his team's preparing for its second launch.
What we flew before, where like it only reached an altitude of like 3,000 feet, but this one's going like miles into space. And so, yeah, I'm most excited about that and the data that we're going to retrieve.
And once that data comes back, says Chinana,
we're going to put it on our computer. We'll analyze it with science. And so
This particular launch was scrubbed because of bad weather and pushed back to August. It will, eventually, be one of several here this year, including resupply missions to the International Space Station. NASA's Jeff Reddish runs launches at the facility. He says even though they're busy now,
within the next 5 to 6 years, we've got an uptick in tempo here, about 200% increase in what we're doing.
Thanks to a mix of government and commercial business.
We're looking at some point in time in the decade being able to launch 50 to 60 rockets out of Wallops.
The flight facility is the country's oldest rocket range in continuous use. The military had its first launch from here in 1945 before NASA even existed. Now it's one of the major employers in the area.
This is F-10 building at Wallops Island. This is where we do all the manufacturing for the suborbital sailing rockets.
James Rule is one of about 2,000 people who work at the flight facility. He moved to the area from Pennsylvania in the 80s. Now he's the manufacturing supervisor of the on-site rocket factory.
Generally, in each payload, there's about 150 to 200 machine parts that go inside of it, and we make all those in here. I want you to see inside of this machine here.
While lots of people move here to work at Wallops, it's a big deal for locals, too.
It's huge. You can just see the influx of tourists just for the launches.
John Farrell is a journeyman CNC operator in the Wallops facility.
It's nice when you can graduate from here, go to college, and then work here and never really have to go anywhere else. So that part of it's really nice.
Farrell says working here is a better and better paid alternative for many who might otherwise work at a large poultry processing plant nearby or in the region's well-developed tourism industry. Wallops Island is right next to the island of Chincoteague. Yes, the same Chincoteague of the Misty stories by Marguerite Henry. Now, the launches are drawing a whole new type of tourist.
I mean, we got one of the best viewing areas for the rockets. So we have a lot of customers that come just to see the rockets.
Donna Mason owns the Waterside Inn. She's watched Henry's books transform Chincoteague from a small fishing village into a popular tourist destination that draws tens of thousands of visitors in the summer. And now she sees it getting a boost from the space industry.
Especially in the winter. It has a positive impact in the off season for sure.
Mason was excited to hear even more launches are coming.
I think it's the wave of the future. And I think that it's smart of our political people to support it because ever who controls space controls the world.
Now, you know what this spaceport could really use? A cantina. In Chincoteague, Virginia, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
When we talk ocean transport on this program, it's usually in the context of shipping and cargo loads and containers. But for some, the ocean is a place for business on a much smaller scale. Last year, the global yacht market was valued at nearly $9 billion. That's from Grandview Research, by the way. So even if you're not part of the uber-wealthy elite, there's still a lot of that $9 billion pie to go around, which does bring us to this latest installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Emily Greenberg. I'm a yacht broker, sailor. I do yacht maintenance, and I work out of New York and North Carolina and everywhere and waterway in between. A yacht broker is like a real estate broker, except you're dealing with boats instead of property, and you make way less money. This year, I did a bunch of calculations. I'm going to make $33,000, but for me, the sea calls, so you do what you got to do. So right now, I have a boat under contract, and it was $37,000. But then I have another listing right now that is $250,000 listed at, which it's a lot of money. And it's going to be a particular kind of client who buys that boat.
But yeah, so that's kind of my range. And I'm trying to sell that $200,000 boat this year for sure. I think for me, it started through this blog that I had where I started writing about older, smaller boats. And I sold my childhood friend's uncle's boat and stuff. So that's how I kind of got into it. But at this point, I have gotten enough accolades and have enough sea miles that I just like, I'm not in it for the glory. But yes, I am obviously trying to make more money, and that's why I'm hustling all of these things. I've been lucky enough that when I started out with just my backpack and a boat that I bought for like $2,000 and a dinghy and a hammer, I met a lot of people who were like, oh my God, this girl's going to wash up on shore. We got to help her. And I learned from them and they taught me the ropes, no pun intended. And I feel a little bit sometimes like I already am living the dream, except my boat's not finished. And then I don't have enough money yet to get a bigger boat. But I feel like that I've turned it into somewhat of a career, that there's only room for growth. I feel pretty happy about that.
Emily Greenberg selling yachts up and down the East Coast. Pretty happy about it too, she was, huh? We cannot do this series without you, no matter where you live, what you do. We don't care. We just want to know what is going on in your economy. Marketplace.org/myeconomy is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today, in which rising interest rates affect not just you and me, but Uncle Sam as well. The Treasury Department reported on the deficit today. Remember, deficit is the year-to-year shortcoming in how much we spend versus how much we take in. The total deficits over forever is the national debt. Anyway, what I wanted to tell you goes like this. Over the first 9 months of this fiscal year, that's last October through the end of June this year, the federal deficit was $1.39 trillion. That's the deficit. The Treasury Department covers that gap, of course, by borrowing money, by selling Treasury bonds and bills. And as you know, because we have been telling you, the yield on that Treasury debt has been going up as the Fed's been raising interest rates. That is to say, the yield on those bonds and bills that the government has to pay has been going up. And that gets us to this. From last October to the end of June, the cost of servicing our debt is up 25% from a year earlier, $652 billion extra dollars in higher interest rates. All right, we are going here, though, is your moment of economic context. Should you be a seasoned business leader or economist, there is a Mid-America job opening you might be interested in. The head of the St. Louis Fed, Jim Bullard, is stepping down. He is not a voting member on interest rates this year, but he's generally been pretty hawkish. That is, in favor of doing what it takes to beat inflation. He's also been around for like 15 years, so a lot of people listen to him. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.